Chapter 11. Cabrillo didn't have time for his shower and only barely managed to change out of his workout clothes and get to the Oregon's bridge before Sloane and her group were escorted in by Frank Lincoln. He glanced around quickly as he heard them mounting the outside stairs. The bridge was in its normal state of disrepair and neglect. No one had left any of their high-tech toys lying around to belie the true nature of the vessel. Eddie Seng was again playing helmsman, wearing a battered one-piece utility suit and a baseball cap as he stood casually behind the old-fashioned wheel. Seng was perhaps the most meticulous planner on the corporation payroll, someone for which no detail was too minute. Had his temperament not been one that thrived on danger, he would have made a great accountant. Juan noted Eddie had set the fake telegraph handles to all stop and had even changed over the unused charts to show the coast of southwestern Africa. Juan tapped the faded and stained map.
"Nice touch.
Thought you'd like that." Juan had given no thought to what Sloane McIntyre would look like until the moment she walked through the door. Her hair was coppery red and in a tangled bush from so much wind and sun, giving her a wild and untamed look. Her mouth was a bit too wide and her nose too long, but she had such an open look to her face that these minor flaws were nearly indistinguishable. With her sunglasses dangling at her throat, he could see she didn't have the green eyes of a romance novel redhead, but wide-set gray ones that seemed to take in her surroundings with a quick glance. She carried a little extra weight that made her body more curvy than angular, but the flesh under her arms remained taut, which made Juan think she was a swimmer. With her were two men, a Namibian who Cabrillo assumed owned the penguin, and another Caucasian with a prominent Adam's apple and a sour look on his face. Juan couldn't imagine many scenarios that would place an attractive woman like Sloane in his company. And by their body language, he could tell that while Sloane might be in charge, her partner was extremely angry with her. Cabrillo stepped forward, extending a hand.
"Juan Cabrillo, Captain of the Oregon. Welcome aboard."
"Sloane McIntyre." Her grip was sure and firm, and her gaze was level. Juan saw no trace of the fear she must have felt when they were being fired on.
"This is Tony Reardon and Justus Ulenga, Master of the Penguin."
"How do you do?" Reardon surprised Juan with a crisp British accent.
"By the looks of you, no one appears to need medical attention. Am I right?"
"No," Sloane said. "We're all fine, but thank you for asking."
"Good. I'm relieved," Juan said, and meant it. "I'd take you to my cabin to talk about what just happened out here, but it's a bit of a mess. Let's go down to the galley. I think I can get the cook to whip up a little something."
Juan asked Link to find the steward. The truth was, the master's cabin he used to greet inspectors and harbor officials who came aboard was a disaster zone and had been designed to make visitors want to get off the ship as quickly as possible. The walls and carpet had been chemically infused with a stench of cheap cigarettes that was guaranteed to leave even a chain smoker gasping. And the sorrowful gaze of the velvet clown paintings made most people extremely uncomfortable, as they were supposed to. It simply wasn't the proper setting for an interview. Although the topside galley and adjoining mess hall couldn't be held to a much higher standard, at least they were reasonably clean. Juan led them down a flight of internal stairs with treads of chipped linoleum and cautioned them about a handrail that was kept purposefully loosened. He ushered them into the mess, flicking one of two light switches to snap on the banks of fluorescence. The other switch only turned on a couple of the lights, and two of them would constantly flicker and emit an annoying buzzing sound. Most customs inspectors going over manifests preferred sitting on the bridge floor rather than working in the dining room.
There were 4 mismatched tables in the spacious mess hall, and of the 16 chairs, only 2 looked even remotely similar. The walls were painted in a color Juan called Soviet green, a dull mint hue that never failed to depress. 2 decks below this room was the Oregon's real mess, as elegant a dining area as any 5-star restaurant. He indicated where he'd like them to sit, placing them so they faced a pinhole camera hidden in a picture on one wall. Linda Ross and Max Hanley were in the ops center to monitor the interview. If they had any questions they wanted Juan to pose, they would be passed to him by Maurice, the steward. Cabrillo folded his hands on the tabletop, glanced at his guests, but let his eyes settle on Sloane McIntyre. She returned his gaze without blinking, and he believed he saw a hint of a smile at the corner of her lips. Juan expected fear or anger after what they'd been through, but she almost appeared amused by the whole thing. Unlike Reardon, who was clearly rattled, or the Penguin's captain, who was pensive, most likely hoping Juan wouldn't call the authorities. "So, why don't you tell me who those people were and why they wanted you all dead?" Sloane leaned forward brightly and was about to speak, but Juan added, "And don't forget, I heard what they said on the radio about warning you off last night." She sat back again, clearly rethinking her response. "Just tell him, for God's sake," Tony sputtered when Sloane didn't immediately respond. "It doesn't matter now anyway." She shot him a scathing look, recognizing that if she didn't talk openly, Tony was going to tell Cabrillo everything. She let out a breath. "We are looking for a ship that sank in these waters in the late 1800s. "And let me guess, you think there's treasure aboard?" Juan asked indulgently. Sloane refused to let his sarcasm pass. "I am so certain I was willing to bet our lives on it. And someone else seems to think it's worth killing for." "Touché." Juan looked from Sloane to Reardon. They didn't look like treasure hunters, but it was a fever that could infect anyone. "How did you two hook up?" "In an internet chat room devoted to lost treasures," Sloane said. "We've been planning and saving for this since last year."
"And tell me what happened last night."
"I had gone out to dinner by myself, and when I was walking back to the hotel, 2 men started following me. I ran, and they chased me. At one point, one of them fired a handgun at me. I made it back to the hotel, which was crowded, and they stopped. One of them shouted that the shot was a warning and I was to leave Namibia."
"You recognized them as 2 of the guys on that yacht?"
"Yeah, the 2 with the machine guns."
"And who knew you were in Namibia?"
"What do you mean, like friends back home and stuff?"
"No, I mean who knew what you were doing here? Did you talk to anyone about your project?"
"We interviewed a great number of local fishermen," Tony said. Sloane overrode him. "The idea was to search areas where fishermen lost nets. The seafloor around here is basically an extension of the desert, so I figured anything that could snag a net must be man-made, ergo a shipwreck."
"Not necessarily," Juan said.
"We know that now." Sloane's voice was laced with defeat. "We flew over a bunch of possibilities with a metal detector and found nothing."
"Doesn't surprise me. The currents have had a few million years to expose bedrock projections that could easily catch a net," Juan said, and Sloane nodded.
"So you talked to fishermen. Anyone else?"
Her mouth turned downward as she said, "Luca." He acted as a guide, but I never much cared for him.
"And there was the South African chopper pilot. Peter DeWitt's his name. But no one knew why we were asking about nets, and we never told Pete or Luca what ship we were looking for." Don't forget Papa Heinrich and his giant metal snakes, Tony said tartly. He was trying to further embarrass Sloane. One of Juan's eyebrows lifted.
Giant snakes?
It's nothing, Sloane said. Just a story we heard from a crazy old fisherman. There came a gentle knock on the door. Maurice appeared bearing a plastic tray. Juan had to suppress a smile at the repulsed look on the chief steward's face. In a word, Maurice was fastidious, a man who shaved twice a day, polished his shoes each morning, and would change a shirt if he found a crease. He was right at home in the opulent confines of the Oregon, but get him on the public parts of the vessel and he had the look of a Muslim walking into a pigsty. In deference to the ruse they were playing on their guests, he'd removed his suit jacket and tie and had actually rolled up the cuffs of his dress shirt. Although Juan had a complete dossier on every member of the corporation, the one piece of information even he didn't know was Maurice's age. Speculation ran anywhere from 65 to 80. Yet he held the tray aloft on an arm as steady as one of the Oregon's derricks and set dishes and glasses down without spilling a drop. Green tea, he announced, his English accent catching Tony's attention. Dim sum, pot stickers, and lo mein noodles with chicken. He plucked a folded piece of paper from his apron and handed it to Juan. Mr. Hanley asked me to give you this. Juan unfolded the note while Maurice set out plates, napkins, and silverware, none of which matched, but at least the linens were clean. Max had written, "She's lying through her teeth." Juan looked toward the hidden camera. That's obvious. What's obvious? Sloane asked after taking an approving sip of tea. Hmm? My first officer is reminding me that the longer we're here, the later we're going to be at our next port of call. And where's that, if you don't mind me asking? Thank you, Maurice. That will be all. The steward bowed out and Cabrillo answered Sloane's question. Cape Town. We're carrying lumber from Brazil en route to Japan, but we're picking up a couple of containers in Cape Town headed for Mumbai. This really is a tramp steamer, isn't it? Sloane asked. It was evident in her voice she was impressed. I didn't think any still existed. Not many. Containerization has all but taken over, but there are a few of us picking up crumbs. He gestured around the dingy dining room. Unfortunately, the crumbs are getting smaller so we don't have the money to put back into the Oregon. I'm afraid the old girl is disintegrating around us. Still, Sloane persisted, it must be a romantic life. The sincerity of how she said it took Juan aback. He had always felt the vagabond existence of a tramp ship roaming from port to port, living almost hand to mouth rather than being a cog in the industrial machine that maritime commerce had become, was indeed a romantic notion. A way of unhurried life that was virtually gone forever. He smiled and saluted her with his tea. Yeah, sometimes it is. The warmth of her return smile told him they had shared something intimate. He roused himself to get on with the interview. Captain Ulenga, do you know anything about metal snakes? No, Captain, the Namibian said and touched his temple. Papa Heinrich isn't right in the head. And when he gets a bottle, well, you don't want to know him. Juan turned his attention back to Sloane. What was the name of the ship you were looking for? It was obvious she was reluctant to give it, so he let it pass. Doesn't matter. I have no interest in looking for sunken treasure. He chuckled. Or giant metal snakes. Is that where you were headed today? The place where this Heinrich fellow saw his snakes? Even Sloane realized how ridiculous she had to look in Cabrillo's eyes because she flushed a little. It was our last lead. I figured we'd come this far, we might as well see it through. Sounds kinda dumb now.
Kinda, Juan mocked.
Link knocked on the mess hall's doorframe.
She's clean, Captain.
Thank you, Mr. Lincoln. He had asked Link to search the Penguin for contraband, like drugs or weapons, just to be safe.
Captain Ulenga, can you tell me anything about the yacht that attacked you?
I've seen it at Walvis a couple of times. She comes maybe every month for a year or two. I think she's from South Africa, 'cause only the folks down there can afford such a boat.
Never talked to her crew or anyone who knew them?
No, sir. They come in, fuel up, and go again.
Juan leaned back in his chair, cocking an elbow over the seat back. He tried to link the facts together and come up with a coherent explanation, but nothing really fit. Certain that Sloane had left out crucial elements from her story, he knew he'd never piece the puzzle together and had to decide how much he wanted to pursue this. Rescuing Jeffrey Merrick remained their top priority, and on that front they had enough problems without adding Sloane McIntyre's. Still, something nagged him. Tony Reardon suddenly spoke up.
We've told you everything we can, Captain Cabrillo. I would really like to get off your ship. We have a long trip back to port.
Yes, Juan muttered distractedly and refocused his attention.
Yes, of course, Mr. Reardon. I don't understand why you were attacked. It's possible that there is a lost ship out here loaded with treasure and you got too close to someone's operation. If they are working without government permission, they very well might have resorted to violence.
He gave Tony and Sloane a frank stare.
If that's the case, I advise you both to leave Namibia as quickly as you can. You're both in over your heads.
Reardon nodded at that advice, but Sloane looked like she was going to ignore it. Juan let it go. It wasn't his concern.
Mr. Lincoln, he said, would you please escort our guests back to their boat? If they need fuel, please see that it is taken care of.
Yes, Captain.
The group stood as if on cue. Juan leaned across the table to shake hands with Justus Ulenga and Tony Reardon. When he grasped Sloane's, she pulled him forward slightly and said,
May I speak to you in private?
Of course.
Cabrillo looked at Link.
Take them to the Penguin. I'll escort Ms. McIntyre myself.
They took their seats as soon as the group left. Sloane studied him the way a jeweler inspects a diamond that he was about to cut, looking for the tiniest flaw that could ruin the gem. She came to some sort of decision, leaned forward, and rested her elbows on the table.
I think you're a fraud.
Juan had to suppress a guffaw.
Excuse me, he finally stammered.
You. The ship. Your crew. None of it is what it appears to be.
Cabrillo fought to keep his expression neutral and the blood from draining from his face. In the years since he'd founded the corporation and started traipsing around the globe on a succession of ships all named Oregon, no one had ever thought they were anything but what they appeared to be. They'd had harbor officials, inspectors of every kind, even a canal pilot on their transits of Panama, and no one had shown the slightest suspicion about the ship or its crew.
She doesn't know, he thought. She's fishing.
He had to admit to himself that they hadn't pulled out all the tricks they utilized when they were in port and about to be inspected. But there was no way an untrained person who'd been aboard for all of 30 minutes could see through their carefully laid deception. His heart slowed as he came to this realization.
Care to explain? He invited casually.
The little things, for one.
Your helmsman was wearing a Rolex exactly like the one my father had. That's a $2,000 watch.
A bit too nice if you guys are as poor as you say.
It's a fake, Juan replied.
A knockoff wouldn't last 5 minutes in the salt air. I know because I had one when I was a teenager and working on my father's fishing boat after he retired from the Merchant Marine.
Okay, Juan said to himself. She's not completely untrained when it comes to ships.
Maybe it is real, but he got it from a fence who stole it. You'd have to ask him.
That's a possibility, Sloane said. But what about your steward?
I've been working in London for the past 5 years and recognize English tailoring when I see it. Between his church's dress shoes, custom suit pants, and handmade shirt, Maurice was sporting about $4,000 worth of duds. I doubt he bought them off a fence.
Juan chuckled, imagining Maurice wearing anything secondhand.
He's actually richer than Croesus, but is... How would the English put it?
Dotty. He's the black sheep of an old money family who has been knocking around the globe since he turned 18 and got his inheritance. He approached me last year when we were in Mombasa, asked to be our steward, and said we wouldn't have to pay him. Who was I to turn him down?
Right, Sloane said, drawing out the word.
It's true. Honest.
I'll leave that for now.
But what about you and Mr. Lincoln?
There aren't a whole lot of Americans working aboard ships because Asians are willing to do the jobs at a fraction of the wage. If the company who owns this vessel is as tight as you claim, the crew would be Pakistanis or Indonesians.
Juan made the reply, but she cut him off.
Let me guess. You work for a pittance, too?
My mattress isn't exactly stuffed with cash, Ms. McIntyre.
I bet. She raked her hand through her hair. Those are the little things I figured you would explain away.
How about this?
When I first saw your ship, there wasn't any smoke coming from the funnel.
Uh-oh, Juan thought, recalling how the engineer had forgotten to turn on the smoke generator until after the Penguin was in visible range. At the time, Juan hadn't thought it a big deal, but that oversight was coming back to haunt them.
I first thought that the ship had been abandoned, but then I saw you were making headway.
A few minutes later, smoke starts pouring from the stack, a good amount of it, in fact.
Interestingly, the exact same amount when you were charging toward us at 20 knots as when I was on the bridge and noticed the telegraph was set to all stop.
And speaking of your charge, there is no way a vessel this size could turn that fast unless you have isopod directional thrusters, which is a technology developed long after this ship was built.
Care to explain that away?
I'm just curious why you even care, Juan hedged.
Because someone tried to kill me today, and I want to know why, and I think you can help.
I'm sorry, Sloane, but I'm just the captain of a rust bucket not long for the breaker's yard. I can't help you.
So you're not denying what I saw?
I don't know what you saw, but there's nothing special about the Oregon or her crew.
She stood up and walked unerringly to where the tiny camera had been mounted in the frame of an old picture of an Indian actress who'd been famous 15 years ago. She pulled the picture from the wall and the camera popped free to dangle by its wire.
Oh, really?
This time blood did drain from Juan's face.
I noticed it when you said, "That's obvious," after getting the note from Maurice.
I assume someone is monitoring us right now.
She didn't wait for Juan to reply. I'll make a deal with you, Captain Cabrillo. You stop lying to me, and I'll stop lying to you.
I'll even go first.
She sat back across from him. Tony and I didn't hook up through an internet chat room. We work together in the security division of De Beers, and we really are looking for a sunken ship that might be loaded with about $1 billion worth of diamonds.
Do you know anything about diamonds?
Only that they're rare, expensive, and if you give one to a woman, you damn well better mean it.
That made her smile.
2 out of 3.
2 out of 3, huh?
I know they're expensive, and I know they're rare. So you must have men casually giving you diamonds all the time.
You're certainly attractive enough.
Her smile turned into a little laugh.
No. They are expensive, and you should mean it.
But diamonds aren't rare.
They're not as common as semi-precious stones, but they're not as scarce as you're led to believe. The price is kept artificially inflated because one company controls about 95% of the market. They control all the mines, so they can set any price they wish. Every time a new diamond field is discovered, they are there to buy it up and eliminate any chance of competition. It's a cartel so tight it makes OPEC look like amateurs. It's so controlling that several executives would be arrested for antitrust violations if they ever set foot in the United States. They dribble out stones from their vaults at a very selective pace in order to keep prices at a constant. If inventories dwindle, they increase production, and when there is an excess of stones, they hoard them in their London vaults. Bearing all this in mind, what do you think would happen if $1 billion in diamonds were ever to be dumped in the marketplace?
Prices would drop.
And we lose our monopoly, and the whole system comes crashing down. All those women out there would realize the rocks on their fingers aren't forever after all. It would also ripple through the world's economy, destabilizing gold prices and currencies.
That was something Juan knew a little about, since it was only a couple months ago that he and the crew thwarted an attempt to flood the world's gold market.
"I see your point," he said. "If such a treasure-laden ship existed, there are two ways our office would prevent this from happening. Number one is wait to see if someone else finds the diamonds and simply buy them all outright. Obviously, this would be expensive, so we would want to take the second route.
Check to see if the rumor of a sunken treasure is true and find them for yourselves."
Sloane touched the tip of her nose.
Bingo.
I was the person who first pieced together the story behind the treasure, so I was given the lead on this trip. Tony's ostensibly my assistant, but he's absolutely worthless. This is a big deal for me and my career. If I could find the stones, I would probably be named VP.
"Where did the diamonds come from?" Juan asked, interested in what she had to say despite himself.
"Fascinating story there. They were originally mined in Kimberley by members of a tribe called the Herero. The Herero king knew there was a battle coming with the German occupiers of his homeland and thought if he had the diamonds, he could use them to buy English protection. For a decade or so, his men worked in Kimberley and snuck stones back to Hereroland when their contracts ended. From what I was able to learn, workers would cut themselves in the arm or leg a couple of months before starting their contracts. When they arrived at Kimberley, charts of their bodies were made noting all the old scars they had. Once they were in the workers' compound, a tribesman who had been there for a while and had already pilfered a suitable stone from the pit would reopen the wound and slip it inside. When it came time to leave a year later, the guards at the workers' compound would check the chart made when the Herero first showed up. They would often surgically reopen fresh scars to check for hidden stones, a popular smuggling system after the more obvious down-the-throat technique, which was literally voided with laxatives. But the old scar was on their chart and wouldn't be checked.
"Damn clever," Juan remarked.
"According to what I was able to discover, they had sacks and sacks of only the largest and clearest stones when the tribe was robbed."
"Robbed?"
by 5 Englishmen, one just a teen whose parents were missionaries in Herero Land. I was able to put the story together from the father's journal, because after the robbery he went to track his son. His journal reads like a torturer's checklist of things he wanted to do once he caught the boy. I won't bore you with the details, but the teenager, Peter Smythe, hooked up with an adventurer of the old school named H.A. Ryder, as well as 3 other men. As part of their plan, they cabled Cape Town to have a steamship, the HMS Rove, wait for them off the coast of what was then called German Southwest Africa. They planned to cross the Kalahari and Namib deserts on horseback and meet up with the ship. And I take it the Rove was never heard from again. She left Cape Town right after receiving the telegram from Ryder and was later reported lost at sea. Say all this is true and not another myth like King Solomon's Mines. What makes you think it would be in this area? I drew a straight line west from where the diamonds were stolen to the coast. They were crossing perhaps the worst stretch of desert on the planet and would have taken the most direct route. That puts the rendezvous with the Rove about 70 miles north of Walvis Bay. Juan found another hole in her logic. Who's to say the Rove sank after steaming back to Cape Town for a week? Or what if the men never made it and the stones are someplace in the middle of the desert? Those are the same 2 points my boss threw at me when I brought this to him. And to that I said, if I was able to figure all this out, then someone else could too. And $1 billion worth of diamonds could be sitting a couple miles offshore where anyone with scuba tanks and a flashlight could find them. To which he said, I'll give you a week and Tony Reardon to help you. And no matter what, destroy all the evidence you've gathered. That isn't anywhere near enough time to check an area that must be a couple hundred square miles, Juan said. To do it properly, you'd need a ship able to tow a side-scan sonar unit as well as metal detection gear. And even that isn't guaranteed. Sloan shrugged. They didn't put much credence in my idea. Giving me a week, a little money, and Tony was more than I could hope, and why I wanted to tap local sources for information. I'm curious. Why did you take this to your superiors? Why not just search for the ship yourself and keep the diamonds if you found them? Her mouth turned downward in a deep frown as if he'd just insulted her, which he had. Captain, the thought never crossed my mind. Those diamonds were mined at a De Beers facility and rightfully belonged to the company. I would no more keep them for myself than I would walk into the vault and load my pockets with loose stones. I'm sorry I said that. Juan was charmed by her integrity. That was way out of line. Sloan said, thank you. Apology accepted. Now that I've told you the truth, will you help? I can't promise you anything, but I'm sure the company will reimburse you for your time if we do find the Rove. It's only a couple hours of your time to check the coordinates Papa Heinrich gave me. Juan said nothing for a moment, his blue eyes cast toward the ceiling as he thought through his next moves. He suddenly got to his feet and started for the door. Would you excuse me a moment? He said to Sloan, then addressed the hidden microphones. Max, meet me at my cabin. He meant the faux cabin they used for customs inspectors. It was the midway point between the elevator up from the op center and the mess hall. Hanley was waiting outside the filthy cabin when Juan rounded the corner. He was leaning against a bulkhead, tapping his pipe stem against his teeth, a sure sign something was on his mind. He straightened when the chairman approached. Even with the door closed, Juan's nose wrinkled at the stale smoke smell emanating from the cabin. What do you think? Juan asked without preamble.
I think we need to stop messing around and get to Cape Town to pick up the equipment we're going to need if we want to rescue Merrick before he dies of old age. Besides that, the whole thing sounds like a crock to me.
I'd agree totally if we hadn't seen the attack on the penguin for ourselves.
Juan paused, marshaling his thoughts.
You think we've stumbled onto something? Max asked to prod his friend.
Guys on million-dollar yachts don't go blasting away at someone without a damn good reason. In this case, I believe they're protecting something.
Sloane says no one knew what vessel they were looking for, so it's possible they're guarding something other than a purported treasure ship.
You don't seriously believe in Papa Heinrich's giant metal snakes.
Max, there's something here. I can feel it.
Juan turned to his friend, catching his eye so there would be no misunderstanding.
Do you remember what I told you just before we took on those two guys from Numa headed for Hong Kong Harbor?
They were checking out the old SS United States. That was the mission you lost your leg, Max said, his voice matching Cabrillo's introspective tone.
Juan unconsciously shifted, placing his weight on the limb made of carbon fiber and titanium.
The mission that cost me my leg, he echoed.
Max stuck his pipe in his mouth.
It's been a couple of years, but I believe your exact words were, Max, I hate to quote an overused cliche, but I've got a bad feeling about this.
Juan didn't blink and held Hanley's appraising stare.
Max, I've got the same damn feeling.
Max held the gaze a second longer and then nodded. A decade together had taught him to trust the chairman, no matter how irrational the request and no matter how long the odds.
What's your play?
I don't want to delay the Oregon any more than we already have. As soon as I'm away, make for Cape Town and pick up the equipment we need. But on the way, I want you to send up George to have a look where the snakes were spotted.
George Adams was the pilot of the Robinson R-44 Clipper helicopter secreted inside one of the holds.
I'll get the coordinates from Sloan.
You're headed for Walvis Bay?
I want to talk to Papa Heinrich for myself, and also to Sloan's guide and her chopper jockey.
I'll take one of the lifeboats off the topside davits so Sloan won't know about the boat garage or anything else. Though they looked as dilapidated as the rest of the Oregon, the two lifeboats were as high-tech as their mothership. If they had the range, Juan would feel more than comfortable crossing the Atlantic during hurricane season in one of them.
He continued, "This shouldn't take more than a day or two. I'll link back up with the Oregon when you return to Namibia. That reminds me, I've been in the gym for the past couple of hours and haven't been updated. What's the latest?"
Max crossed his arms. Tiny Gunderson's rented us a suitable plane, so that's taken care of. As you know, the ATVs are waiting for us at Duncan Dock in Cape Town, and Murph's got a librarian in Berlin pulling out everything they have about the Devil's Oasis, or, as we now know, the Oase des Teufels. Their break at finding the location where Jeffrey Merrick was being held had come when Linda Ross guessed that the Devil's Oasis might be in Namibia and checked for references using its German name. But after gathering preliminary data, their break seemed short-lived. At the turn of the 20th century, the Imperial German government decided to copy the notorious French penal colony in Guyana called Devil's Island, a remote, escape-proof penitentiary for the nation's most hardened criminals. The German government constructed a maximum security prison in the middle of the desert in what was their most isolated colonial outpost. Built of native stone and surrounded by hundreds of miles of sand dunes, even if a prisoner were to escape, there was no place to go. They would die in the desert long before they reached the coast.
Unlike Devil's Island or even San Francisco's infamous Alcatraz, there wasn't even a hint of rumor that any prisoners successfully escaped from the jail until its closure in 1916 because of the drain the remote facility caused to Germany's wartime economy. A rail line that once serviced the Devil's Oasis had been removed when the prison was abandoned, so there was no reliable access except by air or all-terrain vehicles. Both options posed their own challenges and obstacles, because even a small contingent of captors holding Merrick prisoner would detect either a helicopter or a truck long before Cabrillo could get his forces into attack position. By trolling archived databases and using commercially available satellite images, they were well on their way to finalizing an audacious plan to rescue the billionaire.
Anything from the kidnappers or Merrick's company?
Nothing from the kidnappers, and Merrick Singer is talking with a couple different HRTs. While normally the job of the military or police, there were private companies who handled kidnappings. Though it was not the usual kind of job they undertook, Hanley was presenting the corporation as a hostage rescue team, and while they intended to rescue Merrick Singer's founder no matter what, it wouldn't hurt if they could get a little something for their efforts.
How about Overholt at Langley?
He likes the idea of us being here, so long as it doesn't interfere with any upcoming missions. Also, he confided that Merrick has been a big contributor to the president in the past, and that the two of them had skied together a few times. We do this right, and our stock in Washington's on the rise. Cabrillo grinned wryly.
For what we do, it doesn't matter where our stock is.
When it comes to ops, so far off the books they're actually out of the library, Uncle Sam doesn't have many options. And what do you bet if we pull this off, there will be a flurry of diplomatic messages between the administration and the Namibian government, and in the end, everyone will claim it was an American commando team working with local forces that saved Merrick. Max feigned a hurt expression.
I can't believe you'd say that about the slipperiest agent at the CIA. And if we fail, Juan added, he disavows all knowledge, blah, blah, blah.
Escort Sloan down to the Penguin so she can explain to Reardon that she's remaining aboard, and get someone to unlimber the portside lifeboat. I need to shower and pack.
I wasn't going to say anything, Max said as he started down the hallway. But even standing upwind, you're pretty gamey.
Juan peeled off the graying uniform shirt he'd worn for Sloane's benefit as soon as he was through the door to his real cabin and had his shoes kicked off by the time he reached his bathroom. He turned the gold taps in the shower stall to a comfortably cool temperature and removed the rest of his clothing. He leaned against the glass enclosure to pull his leg from his prosthetic limb's suction socket. The powerful multi-head sprays of water cascaded over him, and while he'd liked time to think through his decision to help Sloan McIntyre, he knew enough to trust his instincts. He doubted there was a treasure ship in these waters as much as he doubted the seas were infested with monstrous steel snakes. But there was no denying the fact that someone wanted Sloan to suspend her investigation. That was what he wanted to discover for himself, who they were and what they were protecting. After toweling off and refitting his artificial leg, Juan threw some toiletries into a leather dop kit. From the wardrobe in his bedroom, he tossed a couple changes of clothes into a leather bag and some sturdy boots. Next, he went back to his office. He sat at his desk and spun the chair around to face an antique safe that had once sat in a train depot in New Mexico. His fingers on the dial were well practiced and fast. When the final pin clicked in place, he spun the handle and heaved open the heavy door. Besides bundles of $100 bills, 20-pound notes, and stacks of a dozen other currencies, the safe contained his personal arsenal. There was enough firepower in the big safe to start a small war. 3 machine pistols, a couple assault rifles, a combat shotgun, a Remington 700 sniper rifle, plus drawers containing smoke, fragmentary and flashbang grenades, as well as a dozen pistols. He gauged the possible situations he could be facing and grabbed a micro Uzi submachine gun and a Glock 19. He would have preferred the FN-57 pistol, which had quickly become his favorite handgun, but he wanted interchangeability of ammunition. Both the Glock and the Uzi used 9mm. The 4 magazines were stored empty to preserve their springs, so he took a moment to load them. He stuffed the weapons, magazines, and a spare box of ammo under the clothes in his bag and finally dressed in lightweight duck trousers and an open-collared shirt. He caught his reflection in the glass covering a picture on one wall. His jaw was firmly set, and behind his eyes he could almost see the embers of anger stoking into a fire. He owed Sloane McIntyre nothing. Nor did he owe anything to Jeffrey Merrick, but he would no more abandon them to an unknown fate than he'd strand a little old lady at a busy intersection. Cabrillo snatched the bag off his bed and started topside, his body already responding to the first tingle of adrenaline.